Hello and welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to the Overthrows podcast. I'm Behram Kazi, who you can find at DefMango on Twitter. And with me, as always, is Jared Kimber, who you can find absolutely everywhere. And the premise of this particular Overthrows podcast is South Africa's win at the Centurion, right? A thriller at the Centurion, which they, you know, won versus Pakistan by 2 wickets. It was one of those contests which ebbed and flowed like crazy, and either team could have really won it. But South Africa have ultimately, or did go on to, seal their berth in the World Test Championship final in dramatic fashion. And the celebrations were crazy. And I mean, it's amazing, right, to see them do this with this team, which is quite inexperienced. And then they also basically just kind of gave a walk away to New Zealand at the start of this World Test Championship final. And yet they've made it to the final with ease. They're the first team to make it, in fact.
If you go back and you look at the 3 tests they've played so far in this homestand, what did they get bowled out for against Sri Lanka? Was it 180-odd in one of those tests? And I was pretty confident they were going to come back and take some wickets, but they bowled Sri Lanka out for like negative 12 or whatever it was in that innings, right? Here again, getting themselves into trouble. I thought they could have ended up with a first innings deficit. They end up with a first innings lead.
A healthy
but then
one.
They allow Pakistan
a very healthy lead. 90 runs on that Centurion wicket is huge.
Yeah. And then they managed to let Pakistan set them a tricky target. And then again, they look like they're coasting for a little while there and it just all completely falls apart. They are not a consistent or trustworthy side, I don't think, because I think we give a little bit of credit to Sri Lanka and Pakistan for some of the way they played. But there have been times when you've been looking at this South Africa team going, geez, this is not robust. This is a castle made of sticks, right?
Yes.
Not of concrete. And again, though, they found a way. And I have to give them all respect for that, the ability to get there at the end and find their way. And good on them for that. But yeah, it's the way they celebrated. They celebrated like a team that thought, oh, shit, we fucked this up.
Yeah. No, and I mean, that's another final for them, right? If you think about it, the women's team has made 2 consecutive T20 World Cup finals. The men's team lost a T20 World Cup final, which they should have won. And now they've made the final of the World Test Championship. KG Rabada is that sort of guy who really has been vocal about how much he values Test cricket. So I can understand those emotions. And that partnership at the end between Jansen and Rabada, where South Africa needed 50 runs with 2 wickets in hand, and Mohammed the Boss was on a tear, right? The guy who hadn't played Test cricket in 3+ years. It was cinema.
Is he good at Test cricket? let's park that, because I've never mentioned this before. But
you've never written about it countless times. But yeah, I mean, just those emotions really, they hit hard. Even as someone, you know, who wouldn't have minded Pakistan winning this Test match, I really, really was happy for South Africa. And I've got a bone to pick with some of the people who were, you know, pissing about on Twitter saying that, oh, the World Test Championship format sucks and South Africa didn't even play England and Australia and only defeated India at home once and they get to play a final. Why are we realizing this in the third edition? This format has been flawed from day or has been flawed from day one. It's been bereft of equity since the get-go. And now that some of your darling rich kids don't make it, it's a problem? I don't get it.
Yeah, it was a problem before. And we always knew it was a problem. It's weirdly stacked. 4 teams like South Africa, Sri Lanka, and New Zealand to do better.
Absolutely.
This is the funniest thing about the World Test Championship is somehow the big three have come up with a system that doesn't actually benefit them. Like England have just give up. England are just like, we don't care. Australia in the first one kind of didn't care about it. And then they didn't make the final. And then they to be fair, I think they've played for it since. India is the only one of the big three teams, I reckon, from the beginning were like, this is something we want to do.
Yep.
This means a lot to us. We've been playing really good cricket and lots of respect to them there. But yeah, look, to be honest though, I wouldn't say too much of people have started saying it's a bad format. I would say I am about once a week, Behram, and I'm not joking. Someone will email me or send me a direct message somewhere saying, Jared, so I've come up with a way of fixing the World Test Championship, right? And I say the same thing every time. We all know that there's about 100 ways to fix the World Test Championship. Your system is as good as the other 83,000 ideas that I have been sent over the years. It doesn't matter because they're not trying to make it a good system.
Yeah,
right?
It's crazy
they're
how just, the big three wants a proliferation of Test cricket as far as they're concerned, but that reduces their chances of making the final. But then the more test cricket you play, the better you're supposed to get. At that same time, if you're playing two test match series and then you win 2-0, that's a heavy bump as far as percentage points are concerned. So yes, it's definitely flawed. It was always flawed. But I suppose it's a win for cricket if, you know, one of the poor kids makes it. And South Africa, for the longest time, were struggling financially. So this is going to be a very good boost for them making it to Lords.
Definitely. And also, to take that a step further as well, not just the poor kids making it, but a team that it meant a lot to.
Yes.
Right? I'm not saying it hasn't, you know, but it meant a lot to New Zealand. I think it meant a lot to the Australian team, and it certainly has meant a lot to India. You know, English fans are hilarious. The minute you mention the World Test Championship, they're like, no one cares. It's like, actually, they do. Like, I mean, I've talked to players, and they're like,
Ben Stokes doesn't understand it. He doesn't understand how it works.
It's not that hard. We can take you through it if you need some help. I can't get on that. But look, this is a weird South Africa side. But to be fair, they've fixed some of their batting issues. Their bowling hasn't got any worse. And they've won this test match with Corbin, Bosch. And Dane Patterson, right? Like, this is not a great South African bowling lineup.
Nope.
Right? And they still managed to do really, really well. You know, they got the bowling order weird as well. Why was Marco Jansen a second change in the second innings?
Yeah, I didn't understand
was he
that
injured?
Either.
Did I miss something? I mean, I was sleeping for lots of this. So if I missed something, I apologize to everyone. But it seemed a bit odd.
Sick for a lot of this. I was sweating my ass off for a lot of this, right? On my painkillers and steroids and all that stuff. But, you know, despite taking all of those meds, after watching this particular test match, I was like, test cricket is a better drug than all of the other shit that I've taken or consumed within this while. It was just absolute theater. And I mean, to be fair, Pakistan had so many moments to win this. Like in the first innings, or South Africa's first innings, they had reduced them to 213 for 8. South Africa led by 2 at that point. And that's when Corbin Bosch, like completely, like, you know,
mate, I take it back a step further. When they got Ryan Rickleton out, they were 24 for 2. Ball was doing everything. It was Shahzad, wasn't it? And
yes.
Abbas was actually bowling quite poor at that stage. If Abbas was bowling normal Abbas at that stage, I reckon South Africa would be lucky to get to 120 without losing 6 wickets. And then, as you said, they still managed to pull it back, you know, when Nazim Shah started taking wickets and Ahmad Jamal took some wickets later on as well. So they pulled it back from that, got themselves into a good position. They also, with the bat, what was it when Baba and Saud were batting? What were they?
They were looking quite healthy. 150 odd for 4, I think.
Yeah. Hmm. And I remember waking up out of one of my stupors and you know, watching a couple of minutes going, okay, I can see how they make 300 here. Like, I think that was within the realms of possibility.
Yep.
And that didn't happen. And then you've got two more. There was the on stumps on day 4, whatever it was, they had them 19 for 3, right? Yeah,
27
for 3. And then, of course...
I think so.
Oh, yeah, sorry. Yep. They had them 19 for 3 before stumps.
Yep.
Right? And then they get them at 99 for 8. Like, Pakistan, how many more chances do you want to win this game, right?
Honestly,
South Africa kept fighting back.
Yep. At 99 for 8, I would be really curious to know what the odds were, right? Because despite South Africa having a really long batting lineup, like if you have Kagiso Rabada at 10, all of a sudden, South Africa, who are not known for having a long batting order, have one. And at 99 for 8, I think everyone would have bet money on Pakistan and lost a lot of money. And whoever bet money on South Africa at that point would have made quite a few. I would assume.
Especially since Bosch made runs in the first innings. Like, so there's an emotional suck. You know, when it comes to betting at that point. So I can tell you overnight, I remember this because I was like, that is madness. And had I stayed awake, I would have put a lot of money on Pakistan in this game. But because I needed to sleep, I didn't want to put my money on. But South Africa were 130. They were like almost not quite unbackable favorites. And I was like, they're 29 for 3. What are we talking about here? Like this is, you know, so the market was really believing in them. But by the time Rabada came in, you're right. I mean, that is... Yeah. Great. And we've seen, is that not the second, you'll be able to tell me, is that not the second 9th wicket partnership where South Africa has beaten Pakistan in the last year and a bit? Was it an 8-wicket eight wickets down that they beat them in the World Cup?
Yep. The Maharaj partnership. I remember that. Actually,
just get the 9th wicket, Pakistan. That's all that your fans ask.
That might have been the 10th wicket, actually. I think they were 1 wicket away in the ODI World Cup. I can't quite recall, but that was really close.
Oh, yeah, because Shamsi came in. But I think it was the 8th. I think it was the 9th wicket partnership that got them really close. Yeah, absolutely. You might be right.
Yeah, no, it was scintillating this test match. And I mean, yes, Pakistan you know, you could make a case that they should have won it, especially when South Africa needed 50 more runs with two wickets remaining. But that's when Kagiso Rabada and Marco Janssen showed their character. Some of those shots that Rabada played were Lara-esque, right? That guy ended with 31, or unbeaten on 31 of 26. I mean, that was a heroic effort.
I mean, every time we see him bat, though, like, he's probably the best failer in Test cricket, isn't he? Because you watch him and you're just like, wow, look how good Kagiso Rabada is. And then you're just like, he still doesn't make any runs. Like, he just doesn't. Varun's playing some shots in here. And we see it again and again with him of he's the best looking shit batter. I'm going to think about this. Who's a more stylish bad batter in the history of the game? You know, Morne Morkel used to have a beautiful back foot cover drive, but couldn't play off the front foot. I can't think of many more stylish guys who just fundamentally could not bat. There's some very technically sound tail-enders, to be fair. But I would go out on a limb to say he's one of the most stylish non-scorers of runs we've ever seen. But he can pick up boundaries back-to-back in a row. He does strike the ball really, really well at times. It's just that he does it so infrequently that it's like he makes Tim Southee look like an all-rounder, right? Like the amount of infrequent knocks that Rabada plays. But he's kind of also perfect for a situation like that because I've seen him go in positions like that before and he has no fear, right?
Yeah.
He just plays through the line and he picks up the ball quite well. He just usually nicks off.
Yeah, and I mean, we all knew, or even in the preview, we discussed how Centurion was going to be one of those surfaces where an all-seam attack makes sense, right? And that's what both teams did. But South Africa were batting till nine. And when I say batting till nine, I mean Corbin Bosch at nine, right? I think that the 150-odd runs that they scored, you know, 8 wickets down in both innings, was the difference in the end. I think that's where South Africa won it. And it's so funny because South Africa are the team we always talk about having, like, specialists. And they went the opposite route and won an important test match.
Yeah, and they've been trying We Are Mulder recently as well, haven't they? They've been thinking about specialists a lot of recent times. Sorry, thinking about all-rounders a lot of recent times. Corbin Bosch, am I right in saying he made runs in one of the T20s or ODIs as well?
So up until the second innings, South Africa's second innings in this test match, Pakistan hadn't dismissed Corbin Bosch. In two games. In the last ODI, he was unbeaten on 40 or 44. And in the first innings of this test match, he was unbeaten on 81, where he had taken the lead to 90. So trust Pakistan to make a hero out of a debutant. It's a very staple thing.
I remember, I didn't see much of his 81 because I think, I can't remember
He got dropped once. It was a really tough one-handed chance by Salman Ali Agha, so I'm not going to berate him for that. But that right there could have been a game-changing moment.
But I remember watching him in the one day, and you know, I know a little bit about him. I followed him sort of as a T20 prospect over the years.
He's clocking 140 plus very, very regularly.
Yeah, and he's popped up, and he was one of those players that I was always told that the issue with him was that he didn't, as a T20 player, he could bowl, but he wasn't specifically a specialist bowler, right? And that he's never really hit, despite the fact that he's a pretty big South African, you know, what's the Tony Gregg line, a broad-shouldered man? He's a pretty big dude. He's actually never really hit the ball off the square in limited overs cricket all that much.
Okay.
And clearly, I think now he's kind of unlocked that. It always reminds me of Chris Jordan. In a few years, Chris Jordan would come out and look like a behemoth and then just steal twos. And I'd be like, eventually one day he's just going to work out how to hit fours and sixes, isn't he? He's too strong physically not to work that out. And so he's been a prospect for a while, but I watched him in that innings against Pakistan and I thought to myself, oh, he's a much smarter cricketer than I understood. And you look at his first class record, he averages over 40 of first class cricket, right? Yeah. Like he might not be a great T20 prospect because he can't just hit fours and sixes all the time, but he's a very smart cricketer and how he develops is really interesting. This is probably he's probably a better bat than he is a bowler, right? But in this game, he managed to do both of those things for them. And to be the fourth bowler in a four-man bowling attack when Dane Patterson is the other bowler.
Yeah.
And both of them, they combined for like 12 wickets in this game.
I mean,
right?
think about it. First innings, I don't know if you caught the start of this test match because you might be sleeping, but I did. It was before my wedding. So I watched day one like in totality.
At your wedding, you had it on your phone.
No, I had it in my hotel room and then I didn't watch the last session. But Pakistan miraculously survived the first hour and they were like 33 for no loss. And I was like, okay, Jansen and Rabada were the guys who were supposed to get them out. And to myself, I thought, okay, this is where they kind of botch it, right? They're going to get out to Bosch and Patterson. And Patterson ends up taking 5 for 61. To his credit, though, he's fresh off a 7 for versus Sri Lanka. And Corbin Bosch, as the fourth bowler, takes 4 for 63. So Pakistan end up with 211, despite South Africa dropping like 4 to 5 catches as well. They really kind of messed things up over there.
A test happens when you're asleep. Where do you find the best match report? A cricketer's backstory is meticulously crafted by a great writer. But it's a day you're not on social media, and so you miss out. We all do this. It becomes almost a full-time job to follow the sport you love. But there is a solution. The emailer Best of Cricket can tell you what the main stories are and the best articles every single day. And when they can't find them, they even write their own. Now, instead of trudging through Twitter or Blue Sky, you can just wait for the Best of Cricket to email or WhatsApp the greatest cricket stories straight to you. Subscribe to Best of Cricket today.
No, you're right. I actually had a bet on South Africa because Rabada was moving the ball everywhere. And Varun also said, like, this is unplayable. And I was watching it and following it before I went to bed. And so I put a bet on South Africa and then they didn't take any wickets.
Yeah.
And so Patterson came on and I was like, oh, I can't invest in Patterson and Bosch. Like, I just, you know, not having... I love that Varun still remembers the exact amount of seam that Rabada got there. But yeah, and then they just absolutely went through them. But based on that, when Pakistan got the ball, I put money on Pakistan. And they, when they took their early wickets and got South Africa in all sorts of trouble. So I ended up, you know, evening out and doing okay. But yeah, I do remember that. Like, it's in a really good debut. And also... credit to Dane Patterson. I still don't think he needed to single out a blogger, podcaster type person. Yep. Like, you know, that person, you know, those there aren't that many people who cover South African cricket.
Yeah,
certainly with that level of passion. I'm not having a go. Like, if it's okay for you to be upset, but like, you pick your targets. If it's Fidos or Telford in Crick Buzz or Crick Info, or if it's, you know, Neil Manthorpe, I'm like, I think that's fair, right? They, you know, they're at a level at which if you want to do that, I still wouldn't do it, but that's just me. But fair play to Patterson. Two tests in a row now. He's been really, really handy to this side. And we didn't like this attack. Do you remember coming in?
Yeah.
We were a little bit worried about this because... you know, we wanted the extra sort of frontline bowler in the lineup. If someone like Bosch was going to play or if Wiyan was going to play, they got it done. Only just, but they got it done.
I think playing Bosch over Wiyan was the smarter choice because Wiyan is like bowling in the mid-120s, whereas Bosch was consistently high up in the 140s, right? He was like the second quickest bowler in this game. So I think...
look, it was the right choice because he made 80 and then he took a fifer, right?
Or fourfer.
I think was it fourth? Didn't he take five for?
No, Patterson took 5 and then Bosch took 4.
Oh, he took 4. Yeah, sorry, he took 5 in the game.
Bosch, he took 5 in the game.
I think looking at the way Abbas bowled and some of the other guys, I think we are Mulder. This might have been a pitch he might have been, could he hit anyway. Whether he would have made the runs, of course, I do not know. But
also,
I could see that happening.
Quick question. Did Corbin Bosch's father also play test cricket for South Africa? Was there something like that at play? Because
I think his father is a professional. His father played one test match.
Oh, there you go.
Yes. His father, if I'm not mistaken, and Fidos wrote an article about it and I never got around to reading it, although it was in my system. Did he play, I'm just trying to bring it up now. He played 2 ODIs and did he play their first or second test match back? Was it was the West Indies one was the first one back? Or was the India the first one back? I always forget that.
I think it was India.
Obviously a big...
might have been
India. It was a big deal for them to play India and the West Indies, obviously, because they hadn't played them before. They went out of their way. That was the test match where, I don't know if you've, this is probably a stupid cricket episode, but South Africa were well on top going into the last day. And they needed 201. And I think Kepler Wessels and Peter Kirsten were scoring. And Merrick Pringle went out and ordered champagne. And it was delivered to the ground. And the West Indians found out about it. Do you want to know who the West Indians were who found out about it? Curtly Ambrose and Courtney Walsh were two of the West Indians who found out about it.
Did they end up popping that bottle of champagne?
So 72 overs were bowled. Ambrose bowled 24 of them. Walsh bowled 22. They basically bowled unchanged for ages in that game. and they took all 10 wickets between them. Wow. And the champagne was popped by the West Indians.
So that's the only test that Corbin Bosch's dad played?
So that was, oh my God, I've now, Tertius Bosch.
Okay.
Who I would have thought was fairly, I wonder how old he would have been. I would have thought he was pretty young when he played. Hmm. And really never, I don't think he was ever that close to the side again. But he, yeah, took 200 wickets in first class cricket, an average of 27, and played, you know, one of the first tests after readmission and everything. So again, really, really a cool story for his son to come along. And, you know, it's a little bit, a slightly different situation to what happened with Bairstow. But a similar thing of, you know, a cricketer growing up and sort of being looked after by the cricket establishment, but not specifically by his father, because obviously his father wasn't around.
Yeah, I mean, it's a fairy tale start to his international career. He had a decent game in the ODI, and now he's come up and scored 81, not out, then taken 4 for 63. So good on you, Corbin Bosch. The best bowler for South Africa in this game, I still believe, though, was Marco Jansen, his 6 for 52 in the second innings. I think that kind of, you know, really propelled South Africa's chances if you look at it in hindsight, because another 30 runs over here, you never know, Pakistan would have won this game, right?
Yeah, I think that was a great spell. Yeah, I think it's definitely worth mentioning that. And the fact that he also went on to be there at the end with the bat, right? Like, you know, really important game again from Marco Jansen.
Yeah, and the player of the match, surprisingly, I would have personally given it to Jansen. But Markram bagged that. The one test match a year where he performs came 89 and 37. So lots of runs. And one thing I really like about Aidan Markram on surfaces that are really difficult to bat on is that if you offer him any width, he will capitalize on it. And that's what he did over and over and over again.
I was, as I said, I bet on Pakistan, right? Mm. And I watched Markram and I was just like, oh, he's just going to make runs.
Yeah.
Like I just had no doubt that he was going to make runs. And, you know, usually I would ride that bet far further and I was like, nope. I'm not gonna do that. I can see right here that Aidan Markram is gonna make runs, and yeah, it's a bit weird, I suppose. But his two knocks were really, really important. You could easily have given it. You know, I mean, batters get it all the time. I probably would have given it to Bosch. I think if you make 81 down the order and also chip in with 5 wickets, that's a pretty good game for a number 9 to be playing. And Markram and Jansen also had claims on it. But yeah, I did think Markram played really well. You look at him, and I was watching him face Abbas and make Abbas look a bit silly. And I know Abbas wasn't playing great in that first innings. But you watch him and you just go, how do you not average 45 in Test cricket?
Yeah.
Maybe 50, right? He is so talented. I don't think people realize how talented Aidan Markram is.
Do you remember the knock versus India that came last year? How does he do these things?
T20.
Yeah.
Sometimes you watch him in a T20 game and he blocks it for like 20 balls and then you just like everything else he could hit for 6. Hmm. Like he is talented on such a ridiculous level and it just, and he's a smart cricketer and yet he's never managed to unlock his own talent. I'm so confused with Aidan Markram and remain so and will always remain so.
Yeah. I mean, it is one of those cases where he's definitely better than his numbers, but then he's played so much that his numbers really should be better by this point.
Yeah,
so it's a paradox. It's a massive paradox. But anyway, I think we've discussed South Africa enough and how they, like a lot of different people chipped in to get them this victory, which matters a lot because now they've sealed their berth in the World Test Championship final. But a bit on Pakistan as well. Spoken about how they had their moments and couldn't capitalize. But let's talk about their bowling overall, right? I think Khurram Shahzad was brilliant with the new ball at the start. And he ended up with 3 wickets in that innings. And there was this one phase in the middle where there was a very solid partnership between, I reckon it was Markram and Temba. And then Naseem Shah came in and he took a couple of wickets and he also ended up with 3 in that first innings. But then, of course, you have South Africa at 213 for 8. You should never be conceding 301. That was a missed opportunity. And as you said, Abbas wasn't, you know, kind of in his zone in that first innings. But when he came back, he took 6 for what? I can't even remember. 6 for 54, bowling 19.3 overs on the trot. The guy who hadn't played Test cricket for 3+ years, I mean, which was Pakistan's loss and Hampshire's gain, he came in and he just continuously bowled like Shan did with Sajid and Numan, only Abbas bowled seam up. And I mean, this is the guy who people have, or selectors had an issue with, that he had dropped a few yards of pace. Well, that was not his USP.
Pakistan fans kept telling me that's why he's been dropped. And I was like, I don't care if he bowls at 122. He's so ridiculously talented.
Yeah.
I you know how I feel. I just, for me, It doesn't make any sense. And if you don't want to use him in certain situations, his ability to just find the right spot on a pitch and do it. And he looked a little rusty in the first innings, to be fair. Mm. He looked like someone who hadn't played much since the county season. I know he has, but he looked like someone who hadn't quite come back. And I was disappointed in him, right? Mm. And I almost took to Blue Sky to tell everyone that, like, my man was letting me down. And then in the second innings, it all came back, didn't it? Mm. He is on that pitch. I don't know how you play him. I honestly don't. He's kind of more like Asif, but he's a little bit like a combination of Asif and Philander in some ways.
I would say so.
In that, you know, he's in such control of what he does. He is an absolute master of wrist position. And there are very few bowlers like him around. And you don't let go a talent like that. And Pakistan, as they often do, have mismanaged talent. And, you know, looking for a 19-year-old who can bowl 2,000 kilometers per hour sometimes means that you don't pick a, you know, 28-year-old who's had a couple of bad test matches. Mm. And it's the same. Pakistan has the same issue over and over again. We've done this podcast a million times before, and we will do it a million times in the future. Mm. Sometimes it is just quite simply, you pick the guy who has a magic wrist because he has a magic wrist.
Yeah.
If he has a couple of bad games, you can always say, we're going to bring you back, but we're going to bring you back specifically for these pitches or these conditions. They played a test in Bangladesh not that long ago. Sorry, against Bangladesh in Pakistan not that long ago, where it was a good pitch for seam bowling.
Yep.
Where was our man?
Yeah.
I mean, what are you holding him back for? You literally said, we're going to make this a good pitch for seam bowling. And he wasn't even in the squad, was he?
Yeah, I mean, that's the million-dollar question, right? Why he was ignored for so long. And now he's 35, so he clearly doesn't have much left in the tank. But just on his metronomic nature and the fact that he can seam the ball in either direction, so which is his USP, right? Pace was never his USP. It was the fact that he can move the ball in both directions and he can land it with pinpoint accuracy. Varun put a stat up over here. So Varun, if you could bring that real quick. Before the test match, Varun had informed us that the 6 to 8 meter length at Centurion is the best length to bowl at. Pace seamers were averaging like 10.5 in the last 3 years or something like that, or last 5 years, I can't quite recall. And 86% of Abbas's deliveries were delivered in that 6 to 8 meter good length. And when he wasn't challenging or targeting the stumps, he was challenging the outside edge. Whereas other Pakistan bowlers, I felt, didn't bowl straight enough. You know, either they were sometimes too short, or sometimes they bowled with too much width and let South Africa's batters kind of extend their arms. Abbas was giving them nothing. He didn't give them an inch, right? And that's why this was such a tantalizing spell to watch. It was absolute, you know, theater, cinema. It was blockbuster, box office. I can't come up with more words. But it's just one of those reality check moments for Pakistan that you can be such or much better test team than you are if only you know how to utilize your resources. They are like the anti-New Zealand, Jared. That's what I keep calling them. If New Zealand knows exactly how to utilize their resources, Pakistan are on the polar opposite spectrum of that, or end of that spectrum.
Yes, I think that's a very good way of putting it. You can't keep letting players of this level of talent disappear for 2 and 3 and 4 years again and again and hope that you're going to find another 14-year-old, you know, with a mustache who can come in and do it, right? Like, this is not the 80s and 90s. Mm. You're not going up against amateur cricket anymore.
And they didn't have a stock bowler. Like, Muhammad Ali was their choice for the stock bowler option, right? So bring in Abbas, who has some test bowling experience.
And I don't mind him getting dropped when he was struggling a little bit. That we're not saying he should just play regardless. What we're saying is you keep him in the system. You keep him around. Mm. And then you use him when it's advantageous. And if he finds great form again, then you say to yourself, okay, let's keep him around for a little bit longer at the moment. Mm. You know, it's unprofessional, but it's great to see him back. He doesn't look to me like, I don't know how old he actually is. He looks to me like he is 35, though. He doesn't look like a Pakistani 35, right? And so him and Scott Boland look, they're bowling machines, right? They, you know, they look like they can bowl quite a bit into their late 30s if they have to, because they're not straining themselves and everything else. Hmm. I think Mohammed Abbas's problem will be when, on slightly flatter wickets, when people start to use the baseball shuffle or start to bat out the crease to him. But because of his pace, it's even easier to come up to the stumps. Hmm. Rizwan should be up. Anytime anyone does that, Rizwan can come straight up to the stumps. It's much harder for Alex Carey to do that to Scott Boland. It's not for Abbas. And also, Abbas, I think, can hit the stumps more than Boland. So that stat that Varun put up before, where he said 86% of those balls were in a good area. the other 14% of the balls, the vast majority of those would have been bouncers.
Yeah.
Right? Which means that he can hit a length exactly what you want. So if you bring the keeper up to the stumps, he can, and you say to him, I need you to bowl a meter fuller here to keep the stumps and LBW in play. He would be able to do that for 40 straight balls.
Yeah.
Right? And that's the thing that I've noticed about him in county cricket is just his ability to continually bowl in the right spot over and over again for really long spells. And so that's an incredible skill. There aren't that many bowlers in the world who bowl really long spells anymore. Like, you know, Jimmy Anderson and Neil Wagner were two bowlers like that. We don't see that many bowlers now who bowl those 10-over spells. And he could easily bowl a session, right?
Yeah.
And bowl within himself and be fine. Boland can't even do that. Boland's probably too big. You know, to do that without eventually getting tired or injuring himself. Muhammad Abbas could do that. You know, you have him at one end, you had Sajid at the other end, and you don't even need two more bowlers in the game. Just get them two to bowl out your 90 overs a day.
Yeah, absolutely. But anyway, we've spoken enough about Pakistan's bowling, of course, and they had their moments. As far as the batting was concerned, I felt that, look, there are two ways to look at it. You could say that they were a bit too reckless at times. But then on this surface, you want to look for runs as well, because if you keep waiting for the bad ball, it's not going to come and you're just going to get dismissed, you know, defending. So it's a catch-22 situation. But some shots were disappointing. Shan's dismissals, Babar's dismissals in particular, even though one of those deliveries really rose. Varun showed us a graphic of how the Jansen dismissal, there it is, Babar's wicket. Jansen bowled the ball at identical areas, but the wicket-taking ball bounced 30% more than the previous one. So, I mean, there are multiple ways to look at these things. I think there were some positives as well. Kamran Ghulam's streaky 54 or 52 was a positive. He got under the skins of some South African players as well, which was hilarious to watch. I don't know if you caught some of that. But he told Virena to fuck off, and Virena didn't understand, and then he told him to fuck off again. And then Saud Shakeel, I think, was Pakistan's batter of the game, an authoritative 84 in the third innings. Got dismissed by a short one in the first innings, and then played the short ball really well, you know, after that, which I think both of those guys performing is a big surprise for us at Good Areas, because we didn't expect either of Kamran Ghulam or Saud Shakeel to do well in these conditions. They're both dodgy versus pace, and, you know, they were expected to fail. And they came up and scored runs, and Saud in particular looked in complete control in that third innings, was it? Yes. And 84 on that surface, I mean, that's worth gold dust.
No, definitely. And almost won them the game, right?
Yeah.
That innings in the end.
Absolutely.
You're right. We didn't expect
it. Is he Pakistan's best batter now in Test cricket? I think that's a fair claim. Well,
the scores were level. They just needed a conversation. Instead, the only time they met up was at the same end, and Australia would go on to win that World Cup. In HitWicket, you've got those game-changing special abilities at your fingertips. Need to accelerate the scoring? Bang! Activate 2X, and suddenly every boundary is worth double. That's right, a 6 becomes a 12. The opposition won't know what hit them. Or maybe you need to put the brakes on a high-scoring power play. No problem. Unleash the heck, and watch the batter struggle to even score a single run. In fact, they might even end up going backwards. It's absolute chaos. Look at the King of Spin, for example. But there's more to it than just flashy special moves. Every player has their own unique passive traits that add another layer of strategy. Gilly, for example, he's a seam hunter, a nightmare for any pace bowler. And Beefy, well, he's got a golden arm. The longer a partnership lasts, the more dangerous he becomes. HitWicket challenges you to think like a true captain. You've got to analyze your players, understand their strengths and weaknesses, and then use those abilities and traits to outwit your opponent. It is a real test of your cricketing brain. Now, if you excuse me, I've got a strategy to revise.
That's an interesting one. The thing I would say is that the way they played, I know it was a bit reckless and a bit mad at times, right? But they played like a team who was willing to fail and fall on their face.
Yeah.
In a way that Sri Lanka didn't. Sri Lanka played like victims of like, how are we going to, how are we going to do this? And I think Sri Lanka's a better team. I think they've, you know, all things considered, I think they're a better team. But you know, there were some times where I was just like, Sri Lanka, come on. What are you doing? Like, you know, swing your balls around a little bit. Kamran Ghulam swung him around. Like he was willing to look like an idiot in the same way that Sam Constance was, right? They were willing to look like idiots and make it work. And so, you know, you look at the openers with decent strike rates in, I think, in both innings, but certainly in the second innings. They played in a way that I think you have to respect that. They are not a good team in South Africa. And, you know, historically, And they are not a team that we, any of us thought were a realistic chance of winning a test, right? And they should have won this test. And that, a lot of that goes down to the bowling lineup, as we said, very good. But a lot of it goes down to two or three key batters really batting well. And if you look at the strike rates in the second innings, I think Rizwan's strike rate, and he only faces seven balls, is the first guy in the top six to not have a strike rate over 50.
Yeah.
Right? Tough wicket to bat on. And they pushed, and they pushed. And you look at the first innings, Saud Shakeel, he was just going nuts. Was
16,
stage, right?
16 off 5 or something?
14 off 6, okay. You know, with 3 fours. Like, it was ballistic. It was, it was. I didn't know what was happening. But they came at it from that. And then you also get someone like Rizwan, who in both innings was probably playing the more sensible knocks, right?
Yeah.
Like, they had players willing to take those risks, and then they had other players playing their own game plan. Nothing but respect for Pakistan for this game. And it's a shame that they couldn't get it over the line. I mean, I'm glad that South Africa's making the World Test Championship final.
Yep.
But it's a shame for Pakistan that they couldn't get it over the line, because it was another crazy test in 2024 where you're just like, wait a minute, Pakistan is going to beat South Africa?
and you know, prolong this fight for the final, which we still, you know, don't have one contender for, and we don't know who else will make it. Could be Australia, could be India still. I mean, in a mad world, it could be Sri Lanka as well. So we're really nicely set up still. But I feel like, you know, Pakistan chancing their arm was the right ploy. Because if you wait for too long, you're going to get dismissed anyway. And we've seen Pakistan do that in the past. So I know a lot of people are bashing them for the way they got out, but I actually like their approach. And I think that that was the way to go in Centurion. And Saud Shakeel versus the short ball was a main highlight for me. I thought, because that's something I didn't know which was possible. Him and Kamran Ghulam scoring runs was massive for me.
Yeah. I mean, in the end, they got enough runs to put themselves in a position to win the game. So the chancing worked. A bit like the Sam Constance one that we talked about in the previous conversation.
Absolutely.
Whether it will work again. I kind of think with what Sam Constance did and what Pakistan did here, it's a bit like the Muhammad Ali versus George Foreman fight, where he leads with his right hand. Hmm. You kind of only get away with that stuff once or twice.
Yeah.
Right? Do you know what I mean? It's a bit like England and baseball. It's like, we all know what's going to happen now. And so if they beat you now, they're beating you not with surprise anymore. They're beating you with tactics and a method. And it's a bit the same with Constance and with Pakistan, where you're just like, okay, well, you're going to have to come up with something else. But they kept themselves in the game, and they are going to feel better than they would have if they'd just been blown off the stage. They weren't blown off the stage. They played good cricket. They should be happy with that.
I think so.
I mean, they'll be furious that they gave that game up, but they should be happy that they got themselves into a position to win that game several times against a team who is going to the World Test Championship, much more suited to those conditions. Mm. And Pakistan have been, you know, a hilarious basket case of nonsense.
Yeah, Pakistan, one thing they do, or Shaan Masood does in particular, is that he is attacking and then all of a sudden he gets scared and then the field spread out a bit. That's something I don't understand. He takes the foot off the gas a bit, but maybe that's something he can learn from. I thought that that was an error that he made in this test match. But anyway, before we end this podcast, the last time we spoke about the series, or when we were previewing it, we lost you, Jared.
Before you were married.
Yeah. Before I was married and before your internet crashed ballistically. I wanted to ask you, what should Pakistan do with Babar Azam? Because he'll definitely come back in. And the two options were that either you bench one of Ghulam or Saud Shakeel to make way for him, or you bench one of the openers and then send Babar at three. That's what happened, which was, I think, the right call. 19 test innings without a 50. Sure, he didn't look great, but he ended that streak, scoring a 50 in his second dig. Not his best work, but that's still something. Should Pakistan fans be relieved?
Yeah, I don't think he's a number three, so I don't want him to have too much success there and stay there. But I thought he looked good. He made a 50 in one of the ODIs. I feel like I watched that as well.
Two 50s, back-to-back 50s. Yeah. Really slow ones, he did, but he did spend time out in the middle.
And I remember he faced the young leg spinner. And that young leg spinner, I forget the South African leg spinner's name.
Nkaba Peter?
It might be him, yeah. Hmm. He bowls, I've seen him bowl before, he bowls slightly back of a length, short and skiddy. And I remember watching Baba go back, pick up the length really quickly, and then not just pick up the length, but then demoralize the ball for six. And I thought to myself, he just looks like his rhythm and his, you know, his movements are back a little bit and he feels a little bit more confident. So I was happy that he got back in the test. He's got a 50. But yeah, he's probably not a number three. But I don't, I mean, Probably if you really want to ask me who the number three is, it's probably Rizwan.
You think?
Right?
Because I was going to suggest maybe Kamran Ghulam.
I don't think there's any number three.
Because Kamran Ghulam is going to be or bat like a funny man anyway. So might as well do that at three.
Well, there is. That's my other option is that you just say to Ghulam, look, mate, just go out there for the vibes. I remember playing club cricket with this guy once and we couldn't work out what to do with him. He had the best technique you'll ever see, but he made like 25 every game and then wouldn't go on. Right. And I said, let's just bat him at number three. I said, because he doesn't seem to notice what position he comes in the game. Like he had almost like a callous like bubble. Yeah. Right. And there are some people that it's like, if you just tell them that they're number three and they will just, they'll almost find a persona to match it. Hmm. And he's already got the persona, the nonsense persona. So just,
yeah,
mate, just say, do you know what? We thought you played great. We think you should bat three.
Hmm. I mean, it works sometimes, right? Number three is a really precarious position in Test cricket anyway. And right now, you don't see a lot of number threes out there making runs. So if you've got a guy...
We should make a video about that.
Yeah, we should. So if you've got a guy who you don't expect to perform in these conditions, just tell him to go out there and have some fun at number three. That's what I would do.
Just pick Jacob Bethel.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I mean, that's essentially what England did, right? But anyway...
Oh, Tristan Stubbs. I mean, there's been some vibes picked at three recently.
Absolutely. But anyway, let's see how both those test matches now, India, Australia and Pakistan, South Africa in the new year turn out at Newlands and Sydney. And that pretty much wraps up this podcast. So thank you to everyone who sent super chats and thank you for your interactions in the comment section as well. Just a quick reminder, you can go to goodareas.co and bookmark that webpage and that can prove to be a one-stop shop for all the work that we do as part of this team, whether it be written content, videos or podcasts. We'll be back soon enough with more videos, right? I don't know when we're going live again, but you'll see some footmarks and some quick picks and all this that sort of stuff.
Bayram's not getting married is what he's saying, so we'll be doing more stuff.
I'm done with the marriage, or not the marriage, the wedding.
I've just
begun with the marriage. But yeah, there's one more event, so hopefully I'll survive it. My health is really low. Right now I am on lots of meds, so hopefully I'll be back.
You're like one of those video game characters who's looking around for a med pack.
Yes, basically. That's exactly who I am. And like an hour before or 5 hours before my reception, I had like a I was running a very high fever. And that's when I was like, it's time to pop the roids. Hopefully we won't have to do that again. But anyway, thank you to everyone for tuning in and we'll see you guys soon enough. That's all for now, folks. Have a good one and goodbye.
Thank you for listening. This podcast has an ad-free version via Patreon, where there are also many other extras as well, including a Discord channel where you can chat to me directly. There is a link to the Patreon in the show notes. We are an independent podcast, so support us any way you can. Maybe give us a review, subscribe, or share on social media. All of these things help us. And when it comes to podcasts, word of mouth is always the best way of making it grow. If we had a guest on, chances are their socials are in the show notes. Please support everyone who comes on this show. I am Jared Kimber, and this is my network. But we also have hosts and co-hosts like Bayram Kazi and Estelle Vassadevan. This network is overseen by Nick McCorriston, and each episode is produced by Ishit Kaburka at Sound Potion Studio. Mukunda Bandredi, or Muku as most people will know, is the head of our YouTube channels, and he also helps out with so many other things like the podcast recordings. And there's so many other people we could thank here, but I just want to thank all the listeners and all the people who help behind the scenes that make this podcast work. If you make a lot of content like me, you will need help. And that is why we use Minvo.pro, a slicing and dicing tool that uses AI to conjure up great clips from your podcast chats and meetings. If you make content, go to Minvo.pro to cut it.